crumbling to dust. The river and the canoe lake dried up. The cabins and the big house burned to ashes. When the tremor stopped, Camp Half-Blood looked like a wasteland after an atomic blast. The only thing left was the porch where Percy stood. Next to him, the dust swirled and solidified into the figure of a woman. Her eyes were closed, as if she were sleepwalking. Her robes were forest green, dappled with gold and white, like sunlight shifting through branches. Her hair was as black as tilled soil. Her face was beautiful. But even with a dreamy smile on her lips, she seemed cold and distant. Percy got the feeling she could watch demigods die or cities burn, and that smile wouldn't waver.
"When I reclaim the earth," Gia said, "I will leave this spot barren forever, to remind me of your kind and how utterly powerless they were to stop me. It doesn't matter when you fall, my sweet little pawn, to Phorcys or Chrysaor or my dear twins. You will fall, and I will be there to devour you. Your only choice now. Will you fall alone? Come to me willingly. Bring the girl. Perhaps I will spare this place you love. Otherwise..."
Gia opened her eyes. They swirled in green and black, as deep as the crust of the earth. Gia saw everything. Her patience was infinite. She was slow to wake, but once she arose, her power was unstoppable. Percy's skin tingled. His hands went numb. He looked down and realized he was crumbling to dust, like all the monsters he'd ever defeated.
"Enjoy Tartarus, my little pawn," Gia purred.
A metallic clang, clang, clang jolted Percy out of his dream. His eyes shot open. He realized he'd just heard the landing gear being lowered. There was a knock on his door, and Jason poked his head in. The bruises on his face had faded. His blue eyes glittered with excitement. "Hey, man," he said. "We're descending over Rome. You really should see this." The sky was brilliant blue, as if the stormy weather had never happened. The sun rose over the distant hills, so everything below them shone and sparkled like the entire city of Rome had just come out of the car wash. Percy had seen big cities before. He was from New York, after all. But the sheer vastness of Rome grabbed him by the throat and made it hard to breathe. The city seemed to have no regard for the limits of geography. It spread through hills and valleys, jumped over the Tiber with dozens of bridges, and just kept sprawling to the horizon. Streets and alleys zigzagged with no rhyme or reason through quilts of neighborhoods. Glass office buildings stood next to excavation sites. A cathedral stood next to a line of Roman columns, which stood next to a modern soccer stadium. In some neighborhoods, old stucco villas with red-tiled roofs crowded the cobblestone streets, so that if Percy concentrated just on those areas, he could imagine he was back in ancient times. Everywhere he looked, there were wide piazzas and traffic-clogged streets. Parks cut across the city with a crazy collection of palm trees, pines, junipers, and olive trees, as if Rome couldn't decide what part of the world it belonged to. Or maybe it just believed all the world still belonged to Rome. It was as if the city knew about Percy's dream of Gia. It knew that the Earth Goddess intended on raising all human civilization, and this city, which had stood for thousands of years, was saying back at her, "You want to dissolve this city, Dirtface? Give it a shot." In other words, it was the Coach Hedge of mortal cities, only taller.
"We're setting down in that park,"
Leo announced, pointing to a wide green space dotted with palm trees.
"Let's hope the mist makes us look like a large pigeon or something."
Percy wished Jason's sister Thalia were here. She'd always had a way of bending the mist to make people see what she wanted. Percy had never been very good at that. He just kept thinking, "Don't look at me," and hoped the Romans below would fail to notice the giant bronze trireme descending on their city in the middle of morning rush hour. It seemed to work, Percy didn't notice any cars veering off the road or Romans pointing to the sky and screaming, "Aliens!" The Argo II sat down in the grassy field and the oars retracted. The noise of traffic was all around them, but the park itself was peaceful and deserted. To their left, a green lawn sloped toward a line of woods. An old villa nestled in the shade of some weird-looking pine trees with thin, curvy trunks that shot up 30 or 40 feet, then sprouted into puffy canopies. They reminded Percy of trees in those Dr. Seuss books his mom used to read him when he was little. To their right, snaking along the top of a hill, was a long brick wall with notches at the top for archers. Maybe a medieval defensive line. Maybe ancient Roman. Percy wasn't sure. To the north, about a mile away through the folds of the city, the top of the Colosseum rose above the rooftops, looking just like it did in travel photos. That's when Percy's legs started shaking. He was actually here. He'd thought his trip to Alaska had been pretty exotic, but now he was in the heart of the old Roman Empire. Enemy territory for a Greek demigod. In a way, this place had shaped his life as much as New York. Jason pointed to the base of the archer's wall, where steps led down into some kind of tunnel. "I think I know where we are," he said. "That's the tomb of the Scipios." Percy frowned.
"Scipio? Rena's Pegasus?"
"No," Annabeth put in. "They were a noble Roman family, and... wow, this place is amazing." Jason nodded. "I've studied maps of Rome before. I've always wanted to come here, but..." Nobody bothered finishing that sentence. Looking at his friends' faces, Percy could tell they were just as much in awe as he was. They'd made it. They'd landed in Rome. The Rome. "Plans?" Hazel asked. "Nico has until sunset, at best. And this entire city is supposedly getting destroyed today." Percy shook himself out of his daze.
"You're right. Annabeth, did you zero in on that spot from your bronze map?"
Her gray eyes turned extra thunderstorm dark, which Percy could interpret just fine. "Remember what I said, buddy? Keep that dream to yourself." "Yes," she said carefully. "It's on the Tiber River. I think I can find it, but I should..."
"Take me along,"
Percy finished.
"Yeah, you're right."
Annabeth glared daggers at him.
"That's not safe," he supplied. "One demigod walking through Rome alone. I'll go with you as far as the Tiber. We can use that letter of introduction, hopefully meet the river god Tiberinus. Maybe he can give you some help or advice. Then you can go on alone from there."
They had a silent staring contest, but Percy didn't back down. When he and Annabeth started dating, his mother had drummed it into his head. It's good manners to walk your date to the door. If that was true, it had to be good manners to walk her to the start of her epic solo death quest.
"Fine,"
Annabeth muttered. "Hazel, now that we're in Rome, do you think you can pinpoint Nico's location?" Hazel blinked, as if coming out of a trance from watching the Percy/Annabeth show.
Hopefully. If I get close enough, I'll have to walk around the city. Frank, would you come with me?"
Frank beamed.
"Absolutely."
"And, Leo," Hazel added, "it might be a good idea if you came along, too. The fish centaur said we'd need your help with something mechanical."
"Yeah," Leo said. "No problem."
Frank's smile turned into something more like Chrysaor's mask. Percy was no genius when it came to relationships, but even he could feel the tension among those three. Ever since they'd gotten knocked into the Atlantic, they hadn't acted quite the same. It wasn't just the two guys competing for Hazel. It was like the three of them were locked together, acting out some kind of murder mystery, but they hadn't yet discovered which of them was the victim. Piper drew her knife and set it on the rail.
"Jason and I can watch the ship for now. I'll see what Catoptris can show me. But, Hazel, if you guys get a fix on Nico's location, don't go in there by yourselves. Come back and get us. It'll take all of us to fight the giants."
She didn't say the obvious. Even all of them together wouldn't be enough, unless they had a god on their side. Percy decided not to bring that up.
"Good idea," Percy said. "How about we plan to meet back here at... what?
3 this afternoon? Jason suggested. That's probably the latest we could rendezvous and still hope to fight the giants and save Nico. Something happens to change the plan, try to send an Iris message. The others nodded in agreement. But Percy noticed several of them glancing at Annabeth. Another thing no one wanted to say. Annabeth would be on a different schedule. She might be back at 3, or much later, or never. But she would be on her own, searching for the Athena Parthenos. Coach Hedge grunted.
That'll give me time to eat the coconuts. I mean, dig the coconuts out of our hall. Percy, Annabeth, I don't like you two going off on your own. Just remember, behave. If I hear about any funny business, I will ground you until the Styx freezes over.
The idea of getting grounded when they were about to risk their lives was so ridiculous, Percy couldn't help smiling.
We'll be back soon, he promised.
He looked around at his friends, trying not to feel like this was the last time they'd ever be together.
Good luck, everyone.
Leo lowered the gangplank, and Percy and Annabeth were first off the ship. Chapter 32. Percy. Under different circumstances, wandering through Rome with Annabeth would have been pretty awesome. They held hands as they navigated the winding streets, dodging cars and crazy Vespa drivers, squeezing through mobs of tourists and wading through oceans of pigeons. The day warmed up quickly. Once they got away from the car exhaust on the main roads, the air smelled of baking bread and freshly cut flowers. They aimed for the Colosseum because that was an easy landmark, but getting there proved harder than Percy anticipated. As big and confusing as the city had looked from above, it was even more so on the ground. Several times they got lost on dead-end streets. They found beautiful fountains and huge monuments by accident. Annabeth commented on the architecture, but Percy kept his eyes open for other things. Once he spotted a glowing purple ghost, a lar, glaring at them from the window of an apartment building. Another time he saw a white-robed woman, maybe a nymph or a goddess, holding a wicked-looking knife, slipping between ruined columns in a public park. Nothing attacked them, but Percy felt like they were being watched, and the watchers were not friendly. Finally, they reached the Colosseum, where a dozen guys in cheap gladiator costumes were scuffling with the police. Plastic swords versus batons. Percy wasn't sure what that was about, but he and Annabeth decided to keep walking. Sometimes mortals were even stranger than monsters. They made their way west, stopping every once in a while to ask directions to the river. Percy hadn't considered that. Duh, people in Italy spoke Italian, while he did not. As it turned out, though, that wasn't much of a problem. The few times someone approached them on the street and asked a question, Percy just looked at them in confusion, and they switched to English. Next discovery. The Italians used euros, and Percy didn't have any. He regretted this as soon as he found a tourist shop that sold sodas. By then, it was almost noon, getting really hot, and Percy was starting to wish he had a trireme filled with Diet Coke. Annabeth solved the problem. She dug around in her backpack, brought out Daedalus's laptop, and typed in a few commands. A plastic card ejected from a slot in the side. Annabeth waved it triumphantly. International credit card for emergencies. Percy stared at her in amazement.
How did you... No, never mind. I don't want to know. Just keep being awesome.
The sodas helped, but they were still hot and tired by the time they arrived at the Tiber River. The shore was edged with a stone embankment. A chaotic assortment of warehouses, apartments, stores, and cafes crowded the riverfront. The Tiber itself was wide, lazy, and caramel-colored. A few tall cypress trees hung over the banks. The nearest bridge looked fairly new, made from iron girders, but right next to it stood a crumbling line of stone arches that stopped halfway across the river. Ruins that might have been left over from the days of the Caesars.
This is it. Annabeth pointed at the old stone bridge. I recognize that from the map.
But what do we do now? Percy was glad she had said we. He didn't want to leave her yet.
In fact, he wasn't sure he could make himself do it when the time came. Gia's words came back to him. "Will you fall alone?" He stared at the river, wondering how they could make contact with the god Tiberinus. He didn't really want to jump in. The Tiber didn't look much cleaner than the East River back home, where he'd had too many encounters with grouchy river spirits. He gestured to a nearby cafe with tables overlooking the water.
"It's about lunchtime. How about we try your credit card again?"
Even though it was noon, the place was empty. They picked a table outside by the river, and a waiter hurried over. He looked a bit surprised to see them, especially when they said they wanted lunch. "American?" he asked, with a pained smile. "Yes," Annabeth said.
"And I'd love a pizza," Percy said. The waiter looked like he was trying to swallow a euro coin.
"Of course you would, senor. And let me guess, a Coca-Cola with ice."
"Awesome," Percy said.
He didn't understand why the guy was giving him such a sour face. It wasn't like Percy had asked for a blue Coke. Annabeth ordered a panini and some fizzy water. After the waiter left, she smiled at Percy. "I think Italians eat a lot later in the day. They don't put ice in their drinks, and they only do pizza for tourists."
"Oh," Percy shrugged. "The best Italian food, and they don't even eat it?"
"I wouldn't say that in front of the waiter." They held hands across the table. Percy was content just to look at Annabeth in the sunlight. It always made her hair so bright and warm. Her eyes took on the colors of the sky and the cobblestones, alternately brown or blue. He wondered if he should tell Annabeth his dream about Gia destroying Camp Half-Blood. He decided against it. She didn't need anything else to worry about, not with what she was facing. But it made him wonder, what would have happened if they hadn't scared off Chrysaor's pirates? Percy and Annabeth would have been put in chains and taken to Gia's minions. Their blood would have been spilled on ancient stones. Percy guessed that meant they would have been taken to Greece for some big, horrible sacrifice. But Annabeth and he had been in plenty of bad situations together. They could have figured out an escape plan, saved the day, and Annabeth wouldn't be facing this solo quest in Rome.
"It doesn't matter when you fall," Gia had said.
Percy knew it was a horrible wish, but he almost regretted that they hadn't been captured at sea. At least Annabeth and he would have been together. "You shouldn't feel ashamed," Annabeth said. "You're thinking about Chrysaor, aren't you? Swords can't solve every problem. You saved us in the end." In spite of himself, Percy smiled.
"How do you do that? You always know what I'm thinking."
"I know you," she said.
"And you like me anyway?" Percy wanted to ask, but he held it back.
"Percy," she said, "you can't carry the weight of this whole quest. It's impossible. That's why there are 7 of us. And you'll have to let me search for the Athena Parthenos on my own."
"I missed you," he confessed. "For months. A huge chunk of our lives was taken away. If I lost you again..."
Lunch arrived. The waiter looked much calmer. Having accepted the fact that they were clueless Americans, he had apparently decided to forgive them and treat them politely.
"It is a beautiful view," he said, nodding toward the river. "Enjoy, please."
Once he left, they ate in silence. The pizza was a bland, doughy square with not a lot of cheese. Maybe, Percy thought, that's why Romans didn't eat it. Poor Romans. "You'll have to trust me," Annabeth said. Percy almost thought she was talking to her sandwich because she didn't meet his eyes. "You've got to believe I'll come back." He swallowed another bite.
"I believe in you. That's not the problem. But come back from where?"
The sound of a Vespa interrupted them. Percy looked along the riverfront and did a double take. The motor scooter was an old-fashioned model, big and baby blue. The driver was a guy in a silky gray suit. Behind him sat a younger woman with a headscarf, her hands around the man's waist. They weaved between cafe tables and puttered to a stop next to Percy and Annabeth.
"Why, hello,"
the man said. His voice was deep, almost croaky, like a movie actor's. His hair was short and greased back from his craggy face. He was handsome in a 1950s dad on television way.
Even his clothes seemed old-fashioned. When he stepped off his bike, the waistline of his slacks was way higher than normal. But somehow he still managed to look manly and stylish and not like a total goober. Percy had trouble guessing his age. Maybe 30-something, though the man's fashion and manner seemed grandfatherish. The woman slid off the bike.
"We've had the most lovely morning," she said breathlessly.
She looked about 21, also dressed in an old-fashioned style. Her ankle-length marigold skirt and white blouse were pinched together with a large leather belt, giving her the narrowest waist Percy had ever seen. When she removed her scarf, her short, wavy black hair bounced into perfect shape. She had dark, playful eyes and a brilliant smile. Percy had seen naiads that looked less pixie-ish than this lady. Annabeth's sandwich fell out of her hands.
Oh, gods. How?
She seemed so stunned that Percy figured he ought to know these two.
You guys do look familiar, he decided.
He thought he might have seen their faces on television.
It seemed like they were from an old show, but that couldn't be right. They hadn't aged at all. Nevertheless, he pointed at the guy and took a guess. Are you that guy on Mad Men?
Percy!
Annabeth looked horrified.
What? He protested. I don't watch a lot of TV.
That's Gregory Peck.
Annabeth's eyes were wide, and her mouth kept falling open.
And, oh, gods! Audrey Hepburn! I know this movie. Roman Holiday. But that was from the 1950s. How?
Oh, my dear.
The woman twirled like an air spirit and sat down at their table.
I'm afraid you've mistaken me for someone else. My name is Rhea Silvia. I was the mother to Romulus and Remus thousands of years ago. But you're so kind to think I look as young as the 1950s. And this is my husband.
Tiberinus, said Gregory Peck, thrusting out his hand to Percy in a manly way. God of the River Tiber.
Percy shook his hand. The guy smelled of aftershave. Of course, if Percy were the Tiber River, he'd probably want to mask the smell with cologne, too.
Hi, Percy said. Do you two always look like American movie stars?
Do we?
Tiberinus frowned and studied his clothes.
I'm not sure, actually. The migration of Western civilization goes both ways, you know. Rome affected the world, but the world also affects Rome. There does seem to be a lot of American influence lately. I've rather lost track over the centuries.
Okay, Percy said. But you're here to help?
My naiads told me you two were here.
Tiberinus cast his dark eyes toward Annabeth.
You have the map, my dear, and your letter of introduction.
Annabeth handed him the letter and the disc of bronze. She was staring at the river god so intently Percy started to feel jealous.
So, she stammered, you've helped other children of Athena with this quest?
Oh, my dear.
The pretty lady, Rhea Silvia, put her hand on Annabeth's shoulder.
Tiberinus is ever so helpful. He saved my children, Romulus and Remus, you know, and brought them to the wolf goddess Lupa. Later, when that old King Numan tried to kill me, Tiberinus took pity on me and made me his wife. I've been ruling the River Kingdom at his side ever since. He's just dreamy.
Thank you, my dear,
Tiberinus said with a wry smile.
And yes, Annabeth Chase, I've helped many of your siblings to at least begin their journey safely. A shame all of them died painfully later on. Well, your documents seem in order. We should get going. The Mark of Athena awaits.
Percy gripped Annabeth's hand, probably a little too tight.
Tiberinus, let me go with her. Just a little farther.
Rhea Silvia laughed sweetly.
But you can't, silly boy. You must return to your ship and gather your other friends. Confront the giants. The way will appear in your friend Piper's knife. Annabeth has a different path. She must walk alone.
Indeed, Tiberinus said. Annabeth must face the guardian of the shrine by herself. It is the only way, And Percy Jackson, you have less time than you realize to rescue your friend in the jar. You must hurry.
Percy's pizza felt like a cement lump in his stomach.
But...
It's all right, Percy. Annabeth squeezed his hand. I need to do this. He started to protest. Her expression stopped him. She was terrified, but doing her best to hide it, for his sake. If he tried to argue, he would only make things harder for her. Or worse, he might convince her to stay. Then she would have to live with the knowledge that she'd back down from her biggest challenge, assuming that they survived at all, with Rome about to get leveled and Gia about to rise and destroy the world. The Athena statue held the key to defeating the giants. Percy didn't know why or how, but Annabeth was the only one who could find it.
You're right, he said, forcing out the words. Be safe.
Rhea Silvia giggled like it was a ridiculous comment.
Save? Not at all, but necessary. Come, Annabeth, my dear. We will show you where your path starts. After that, you're on your own.
Annabeth kissed Percy. She hesitated, like she was wondering what else to say. Then she shouldered her backpack and climbed on the back of the scooter. Percy hated it. He would have preferred to fight any monster in the world. He would have preferred a rematch with Chrysaor. But he forced himself to stay in his chair and watch as Annabeth motored off through the streets of Rome with Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn. Chapter 33. Annabeth. Annabeth figured it could have been worse. If she had to go on a horrifying solo quest, at least she'd gotten to have lunch with Percy on the banks of the Tiber first. Now she got to take a scooter ride with Gregory Peck. She only knew about that old movie because of her dad. Over the past few years, since the two of them had made up, they'd spent more time together, and she had learned that her dad had a sappy side. Sure, he liked military history, weapons, and biplanes, but he also loved old films, especially romantic comedies from the 1940s and 50s. Roman Holiday was one of his favorites. He'd made Annabeth watch it. She thought the plot was silly. A princess escapes her minders and falls in love with an American journalist in Rome. But she suspected her dad liked it because it reminded him of his own romance with the goddess Athena. Another impossible pairing that couldn't end happily. Her dad was nothing like Gregory Peck. Athena certainly wasn't anything like Audrey Hepburn. But Annabeth knew that people saw what they wanted to see. They didn't need the mist to warp their perceptions. As the baby blue scooter zipped through the streets of Rome, the goddess Rhea Silvia gave Annabeth a running commentary on how the city had changed over the centuries. "The Sublician Bridge was over there," she said, pointing to a bend in the Tiber. "You know, where Horatius and his two friends defended the city from an invading army? Now there was a brave Roman."
"And look, dear," Tiberinus added, "that's the place where Romulus and Remus washed ashore."
He seemed to be talking about a spot on the riverside where some ducks were making a nest out of torn-up plastic bags and candy wrappers.
"Ah, yes," Rhea Silvia sighed happily. "You were so kind to flood yourself and wash my babies ashore for the wolves to find."
"It was nothing," Tiberinus said.
Annabeth felt lightheaded. The river god was talking about something that had happened thousands of years ago, when this area was nothing but marshes and maybe some shacks. Tiberinus saved two babies, one of whom went on to found the world's greatest empire. It was nothing. Rhea Silvia pointed out a large modern apartment building. "That used to be a temple to Venus. Then it was a church. Then a palace. Then an apartment building. It burned down 3 times. Now it's an apartment building again. And that spot right there."
"Please," Annabeth said. "You're making me dizzy."
Rhea Silvia laughed.
"I'm sorry, dear. Layers upon layers of history here. But it's nothing compared to Greece. Athens was old when Rome was a collection of mud huts. You'll see if you survive."
"Not helping," Annabeth muttered.
"Here we are," Tiberinus announced.
He pulled over in front of a large marble building, the facade covered in city grime but still beautiful. Ornate carvings of Roman gods decorated the roofline. The massive entrance was barred with iron gates, heavily padlocked. "I'm going in there." Annabeth wished she'd brought Leo, or at least borrowed some wire cutters from his tool belt. Rhea Sylvia covered her mouth and giggled. "No, my dear, not in it. Under it." Tiberinus pointed to a set of stone steps on the side of the building, the sort that would have led to a basement apartment if this place were in Manhattan.
"Rome is chaotic above ground," Tiberinus said, "but that's nothing compared to below ground. You must descend into the buried city, Annabeth Chase. Find the altar of the foreign god. The failures of your predecessors will guide you. After that, I do not know."
Annabeth's backpack felt heavy on her shoulders. She'd been studying the bronze map for days now, scouring Daedalus's laptop for information. Unfortunately, the few things she had learned made this quest seem even more impossible. "My siblings, none of them made it all the way to the shrine, did they?" Tiberinus shook his head.
"But you know what prize awaits, if you can liberate it."
"Yes," Annabeth said.
"It could bring peace to the children of Greece and Rome," Rhea Sylvia said. "It could change the course of the coming war."
"If I live," Annabeth said. Tiberinus nodded sadly.
"Because you also understand the guardian you must face?"
Annabeth remembered the spiders at Fort Sumter and the dream Percy had described, the hissing voice in the dark. "Yes." Rhea Sylvia looked at her husband.
"She is brave. Perhaps she is stronger than the others."
"I hope so," said the river god. "Goodbye, Annabeth Chase, and good luck."
Rhea Sylvia beamed.
"We have such a lovely afternoon planned. Off to shop."
Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn sped off on their baby blue motorbike. Then Annabeth turned and descended the steps alone. She'd been underground plenty of times, but halfway down the steps she realized just how long it had been since she'd adventured by herself. She froze. Gods, she hadn't done something like this since she was a kid. After running away from home, she'd spent a few weeks surviving on her own, living in alleyways and hiding from monsters until Thalia and Luke took her under their wings. Then, once she'd arrived at Camp Half-Blood, she'd lived there until she was 12. After that, all her quests had been with Percy or her other friends. The last time she had felt this scared and alone, she'd been 7 years old. She remembered the day Thalia, Luke, and she had wandered into the Cyclopes' lair in Brooklyn. Thalia and Luke had gotten captured, and Annabeth had had to cut them free. She still remembered shivering in a dark corner of that dilapidated mansion, listening to the Cyclopes mimicking her friends' voices, trying to trick her into coming out into the open. What if this is a trick, too? She wondered. What if those other children of Athena died because Tiberinus and Rhea Sylvia led them into a trap? Would Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn do something like that? She forced herself to keep going. She had no choice. If the Athena Parthenos was really down here, it could decide the fate of the war. More importantly, it could help her mom. Athena needed her. At the bottom of the steps, she reached an old wooden door with an iron pull ring. Above the ring was a metal plate with a keyhole. Annabeth started considering ways to pick the lock, but as soon as she touched the pull ring, a fiery shape burned in the middle of the door. The silhouette of Athena's owl. Smoke plumed from the keyhole. The door swung inward. Annabeth looked up one last time. At the top of the stairwell, the sky was a square of brilliant blue. Mortals would be enjoying the warm afternoon. Couples would be holding hands at the cafes. Tourists would be bustling through the shops and museums. Regular Romans would be going about their daily business, probably not considering the thousands of years of history under their feet, and definitely unaware of the spirits, gods, and monsters that still dwelt here, or the fact that their city might be destroyed today unless a certain group of demigods succeeded in stopping the giants. Annabeth stepped through the doorway. She found herself in a basement that was an architectural cyborg. Ancient brick walls were crisscrossed with modern electrical cables and plumbing. The ceiling was held up with a combination of steel scaffolding and old granite Roman columns. The front half of the basement was stacked with crates. Out of curiosity, Annabeth opened a few. Some were packed with multicolored spools of string, like for kites or arts and crafts projects. Other crates were full of cheap plastic gladiator swords. Maybe at one point this had been a storage area for a tourist shop. In the back of the basement, the floor had been excavated, revealing another set of steps. These of white stone, leading still deeper underground. Annabeth crept to the edge. Even with the glow cast by her dagger, it was too dark to see below. She rested her hand on the wall and found a light switch. She flipped it. Glaring white fluorescent bulbs illuminated the stairs. Below, she saw a mosaic floor decorated with deer and fawns. Maybe a room from an ancient Roman villa, just stashed away under this modern basement along with the crates of string and plastic swords. She climbed down. The room was about 20 feet square. The walls had once been brightly painted, but most of the frescoes had peeled or faded. The only exit was a hole dug in one corner of the floor where the mosaic had been pulled up. Annabeth crouched next to the opening. It dropped straight down into a larger cavern, but Annabeth couldn't see the bottom. She heard running water maybe 30 or 40 feet below. The air didn't smell like a sewer, just old and musty, and slightly sweet, like moldering flowers. Perhaps it was an old water line from the aqueducts. There was no way down. "I'm not jumping," she muttered to herself. As if in reply, something glowed in the darkness. The mark of Athena blazed to life at the bottom of the cavern, revealing glistening brickwork along a subterranean canal 40 feet below. The fiery owl seemed to be taunting her. "Well, this is the way, kid, so you'd better figure something out." Annabeth considered her options. Too dangerous to jump. No ladders or ropes. She thought about borrowing some metal scaffolding from above to use as a fire pole, but it was all bolted in place. Besides, she didn't want to cause the building to collapse on top of her. Frustration crawled through her like an army of termites. She had spent her life watching other demigods gain amazing powers. Percy could control water. If he were here, he could raise the water level and simply float down. Hazel, from what she had said, could find her way underground with flawless accuracy and even create or change the course of tunnels. She could easily make a new path. Leo would pull just the right tools from his belt and build something to do the job. Frank could turn into a bird. Jason could simply control the wind and float down. Even Piper, with her charm speak. She could have convinced Tiberinus and Rhea Sylvia to be a little more helpful. What did Annabeth have? A bronze dagger that did nothing special, and a cursed silver coin. She had her backpack with Daedalus's laptop, a water bottle, a few pieces of ambrosia for emergencies, and a box of matches. Probably useless, but her dad had drilled into her head that she should always have a way to make fire. She had no amazing powers. Even her one true magic item, her New York Yankees cap of invisibility, had stopped working, and was still back in her cabin on the Argo II. "You've got your intelligence," a voice said. Annabeth wondered if Athena was speaking to her, but that was probably just wishful thinking. Intelligence, like Athena's favorite hero, Odysseus. He'd won the Trojan War with cleverness, not strength. He had overcome all sorts of monsters and hardships with his quick wits. That's what Athena valued. Wisdom's daughter walks alone. That didn't just mean without other people, Annabeth realized. It meant without any special powers. Okay, so how to get down there safely and make sure she had a way to get out again if necessary? She climbed back to the basement and stared at the open crates. Kite string and plastic swords. The idea that came to her was so ridiculous, she almost had to laugh. But it was better than nothing. She set to work. Her hands seemed to know exactly what to do. Sometimes that happened.
like when she was helping Leo with the ship's machinery or drawing architectural plans on the computer. She'd never made anything out of kite string and plastic swords, but it seemed easy, natural. Within minutes, she'd used a dozen balls of string and a crate full of swords to create a makeshift rope ladder, a braided line woven for strength yet not too thick, with swords tied at 2-foot intervals to serve as hand and footholds. As a test, she tied one end around a support column and leaned on the rope with all her weight. The plastic swords bent under her, but they provided some extra bulk to the knots in the cord, so at least she could keep a better grip. The ladder wouldn't win any design awards, but it might get her to the bottom of the cavern safely. First, she stuffed her backpack with the leftover spools of string. She wasn't sure why, but they were one more resource, and not too heavy. She headed back to the hole in the mosaic floor. She secured one end of her ladder to the nearest piece of scaffolding, lowered the rope into the cavern, and shinnied down. Chapter 34. Annabeth. As Annabeth hung in the air, descending hand over hand with the ladder swinging wildly, she thanked Chiron for all those years of training on the climbing course at Camp Half-Blood. She'd complained loudly and often that rope climbing would never help her defeat a monster. Chiron had just smiled, like he knew this day would come. Finally, Annabeth made it to the bottom. She missed the brickwork edge and landed in a canal, but it turned out to be only a few inches deep. Freezing water soaked into her running shoes. She held up her glowing dagger. The shallow channel ran down the middle of a brickwork tunnel. Every few yards, ceramic pipes jutted from the walls. She guessed that the pipes were drains, part of the ancient Roman plumbing system, though it was amazing to her that a tunnel like this had survived, crowded underground with all the other centuries' worth of pipes, basements, and sewers. A sudden thought chilled her even more than the water. A few years ago, Percy and she had gone on a quest in Daedalus's labyrinth, a secret network of tunnels and rooms, heavily enchanted and trapped, which ran under all the cities of America. When Daedalus died in the Battle of the Labyrinth, the entire maze had collapsed, or so Annabeth believed. But what if that was only in America? What if this was an older version of the labyrinth? Daedalus once told her that his maze had a life of its own. It was constantly growing and changing. Maybe the labyrinth could regenerate, like monsters. That would make sense. It was an archetypal force, as Chiron would say, something that could never really die. If this was part of the labyrinth... Annabeth decided not to dwell on that, but she also decided not to assume her directions were accurate. The labyrinth made distance meaningless. If she wasn't careful, she could walk 20 feet in the wrong direction and end up in Poland. Just to be safe, she tied a new ball of string to the end of her rope ladder. She could unravel it behind her as she explored. An old trick, but a good one. She debated which way to go. The tunnels seemed the same in both directions. Then, about 50 feet to her left, the mark of Athena blazed against the wall. Annabeth could swear it was glaring at her with those big fiery eyes, as if to say, "What's your problem? Hurry up!" She was really starting to hate that owl. By the time she reached the spot, the image had faded, and she'd run out of string on her first spool. As she was attaching a new line, she glanced across the tunnel. There was a broken section in the brickwork, as if a sledgehammer had knocked a hole in the wall. She crossed to take a look, sticking her dagger through the opening for light. Annabeth could see a lower chamber, long and narrow, with a mosaic floor, painted walls, and benches running down either side. It was shaped sort of like a subway car. She stuck her head into the hole, hoping nothing would bite it off. At the near end of the room was a bricked-off doorway. At the far end was a stone table, or maybe an altar. The water tunnel kept going. But Annabeth was sure this was the way. She remembered what Tiberinus had said. Find the altar of the foreign god. There didn't seem to be any exits from the altar room, but it was a short drop onto the bench below. She should be able to climb out again with no problem. Still holding her string, she lowered herself down.
The room's ceiling was barrel-shaped with brick arches, but Annabeth didn't like the look of the supports. Directly above her head, on the arch nearest to the bricked-in doorway, the capstone was cracked in half. Stress fractures ran across the ceiling. The place had probably been intact for 2,000 years, but she decided she'd rather not spend too much time here. With her luck, it would collapse in the next 2 minutes. The floor was a long, narrow mosaic with 7 pictures in a row, like a timeline. At Annabeth's feet was a raven. Next was a lion. Several others looked like Roman warriors with various weapons. The rest were too damaged or covered in dust for Annabeth to make out details. The benches on either side were littered with broken pottery. The walls were painted with scenes of a banquet. A robed man with a curved cap like an ice cream scoop, sitting next to a larger guy who radiated sunbeams. Standing around them were torchbearers and servants, and various animals like crows and lions wandered in the background. Annabeth wasn't sure what the picture represented, but it didn't remind her of any Greek legends that she knew. At the far end of the room, the altar was elaborately carved with a frieze, showing the man with the ice cream scoop hat holding a knife to the neck of a bull. On the altar stood a stone figure of a man sunk to his knees in rock, a dagger and a torch in his outraised hands. Again, Annabeth had no idea what those images meant. She took one step toward the altar. Her foot went crunch. She looked down and realized she'd just put her shoe through a human rib cage. Annabeth swallowed back a scream. Where had that come from? She had glanced down only a moment before and hadn't seen any bones. Now the floor was littered with them. The rib cage was obviously old. It crumbled to dust as she removed her foot. Nearby lay a corroded bronze dagger, very much like her own. Either this dead person had been carrying the weapon, or it had killed him. She held out her blade to see in front of her. A little farther down the mosaic path sprawled a more complete skeleton in the remains of an embroidered red doublet, like a man from the Renaissance. His frilled collar and skull had been badly burned, as if the guy had decided to wash his hair with a blowtorch. Wonderful, Annabeth thought. She lifted her eyes to the altar statue, which held a dagger and a torch. Some kind of test, Annabeth decided. These two guys had failed. Correction, not just two guys. More bones and scraps of clothing were scattered all the way to the altar. She couldn't guess how many skeletons were represented, but she was willing to bet they were all demigods from the past, children of Athena on the same quest. "I will not be another skeleton on your floor," she called to the statue, hoping she sounded brave.
"A girl," said a watery voice, echoing through the room. "Girls are not allowed."
"A female demigod," said a second voice. "Inexcusable."
The chamber rumbled. Dust fell from the cracked ceiling. Annabeth bolted for the hole she'd come through, but it had disappeared. Her string had been severed. She clambered up on the bench and pounded on the wall where the hole had been, hoping the hole's absence was just an illusion. But the wall felt solid. She was trapped. Along the benches, a dozen ghosts shimmered into existence, glowing purple men in Roman togas, like the Lares she'd seen at Camp Jupiter. They glared at her as if she'd interrupted their meeting. She did the only thing she could. She stepped down from the bench and put her back to the bricked-in doorway. She tried to look confident, though the scowling purple ghosts and the demigod skeletons at her feet made her want to turtle in her t-shirt and scream. "I'm a child of Athena," she said, as boldly as she could manage.
"A Greek," one of the ghosts said with disgust. "That is even worse."
At the other end of the chamber, an old-looking ghost rose with some difficulty. Do ghosts have arthritis? And stood by the altar, his dark eyes fixed on Annabeth. Her first thought was that he looked like the Pope. He had a glittering robe, a pointed hat, and a shepherd's crook.
"This is the cavern of Mithras," said the old ghost. "You have disturbed our sacred rituals. You cannot look upon our mysteries and live."
"I don't want to look upon your mysteries," Annabeth assured him. "I'm following the mark of Athena. Show me the exit, and I'll be on my way.
Her voice sounded calm, which surprised her. She had no idea how to get out of here, but she knew she had to succeed where her siblings had failed. Her path led farther on, deeper into the underground layers of Rome.
The failures of your predecessors will guide you, Tiberinus had said. After that, I do not know.
The ghosts mumbled to each other in Latin. Annabeth caught a few unkind words about female demigods and Athena. Finally, the ghost with the Pope hat struck his shepherd's crook against the floor. The other Lares fell silent.
Your Greek goddess is powerless here, said the Pope. Mithras is the god of Roman warriors. He is the god of the legion, the god of the empire.
He wasn't even Roman, Annabeth protested. Wasn't he, like, Persian or something?
Sacrilege,
the old man yelped, banging his staff on the floor a few more times.
Mithras protects us. I am the potter of this brotherhood.
The father, Annabeth translated.
Do not interrupt. As potter, I must protect our mysteries.
What mysteries? Annabeth asked. A dozen dead guys in togas sitting around in a cave?
The ghosts muttered and complained until the potter got them under control with a taxicab whistle. The old guy had a good set of lungs.
You are clearly an unbeliever. Like the others, you must die.
The others. Annabeth made an effort not to look at the skeletons. Her mind worked furiously, grasping for anything she knew about Mithras. He had a secret cult for warriors. He was popular in the legion. He was one of the gods who'd supplanted Athena as a war deity. Aphrodite had mentioned him during their tea time chat in Charleston. Aside from that, Annabeth had no idea. Mithras just wasn't one of the gods they talked about at Camp Half-Blood. She doubted the ghosts would wait while she whipped out Daedalus's laptop and did a search. She scanned the floor mosaic. 7 pictures in a row. She studied the ghosts and noticed all of them wore some sort of badge on their toga. A raven, or a torch, or a bow.
You have rites of passage, she blurted out. 7 levels of membership, and the top level is the potter.
The ghosts let out a collective gasp. Then they all began shouting at once.
How does she know this? One demanded.
The girl has gleaned our secrets.
Silence,
the potter ordered.
But she might know about the ordeals, another cried.
The ordeals, Annabeth said. I know about them.
Another round of incredulous gasping.
Ridiculous,
the potter yelled.
The girl lies, daughter of Athena. Choose your way of death. If you do not choose, the god will choose for you.
Fire or dagger, Annabeth guessed.
Even the potter looked stunned. Apparently he hadn't remembered there were victims of past punishments lying on the floor.
How did you?
He gulped.
Who are you?
A child of Athena, Annabeth said again. But not just any child. I am, the mater in my sisterhood. The magna mater, in fact. There are no mysteries to me. Mithras cannot hide anything from my sight.
The Magna Mater,
a ghost wailed in despair.
The Big Mother!
Kill her!
One of the ghosts charged, his hands out to strangle her, but he passed right through her.
You're dead, Annabeth reminded him. Sit down.
The ghost looked embarrassed and took his seat.
We do not need to kill you ourselves,
the potter growled.
Mithras shall do that for us.
The statue on the altar began to glow. Annabeth pressed her hands against the bricked-in doorway at her back. That had to be the exit. The mortar was crumbling, but it was not weak enough for her to break through with brute force. She looked desperately around the room, the cracked ceiling, the floor mosaic, the wall paintings, and the carved altar. She began to talk, pulling deductions from the top of her head.
"It is no good," she said. I know all. You test your initiates with fire because the torch is the symbol of Mithras. His other symbol is the dagger, which is why you can also be tested with the blade. You want to kill me, just as As Mithras killed the sacred bull.
It was a total guess. But the altar showed Mithras killing a bull, so Annabeth figured it must be important. The ghosts wailed and covered their ears. Some slapped their faces as if to wake up from a bad dream.
"The Big Mother knows," one said. "It is impossible."
Unless you look around the room, Annabeth thought, her confidence growing. She glared at the ghost who had just spoken. He had a raven badge on his toga, the same symbol as on the floor at her feet.
"You are just a raven," she scolded. "That is the lowest rank. Be silent and let me speak to your potter."
The ghost cringed.
"Mercy, mercy."
At the front of the room, the potter trembled, either from rage or fear. Annabeth wasn't sure which. His pope hat tilted sideways on his head like a gas gauge dropping toward empty.
"Truly, you know much, Big Mother. Your wisdom is great. But that is all the more reason why you cannot leave. The weaver warned us you would come."
The weaver. Annabeth realized with a sinking feeling what the pater was talking about. The thing in the dark from Percy's dream. The guardian of the shrine. This was one time she wished she didn't know the answer, but she tried to maintain her calm. "The weaver fears me. She doesn't want me to follow the mark of Athena. But you will let me pass."
"You must choose an ordeal,"
the potter insisted.
"Fire or dagger? Survive one, and then perhaps."
Annabeth looked down at the bones of her siblings. "The failures of your predecessors will guide you." They'd all chosen one or the other, fire or dagger. Maybe they'd thought they could beat the ordeal. But they had all died. Annabeth needed a third choice. She stared at the altar statue, which was glowing brighter by the second. She could feel its heat across the room. Her instinct was to focus on the dagger or the torch, but instead she concentrated on the statue's base. She wondered why its legs were stuck in stone. Then it occurred to her. Maybe the little statue of Mithras wasn't stuck in the rock. Maybe he was emerging from the rock. "Neither torch nor dagger," Annabeth said firmly. "There is a third test, which I will pass."
"A third test?"
the potter demanded.
"Mithras was born from rock," Annabeth said, hoping she was right. "He emerged fully grown from the stone, holding his dagger and torch."
The screaming and wailing told her she had guessed correctly.
"The Big Mother knows all," a ghost cried. "That is our most closely guarded secret."
"Then maybe you shouldn't put a statue of it on your altar," Annabeth thought. But she was thankful for stupid male ghosts. If they'd let women warriors into their cult, they might have learned some common sense. Annabeth gestured dramatically to the wall she'd come from.
"I was born from stone, just as Mithras was. Therefore, I have already passed your ordeal."
"Bah!"
the potter spat.
"You came from a hole in the wall. That's not the same thing."
Okay, so apparently the pater wasn't a complete moron. But Annabeth remained confident. She glanced at the ceiling, and another idea came to her. All the details clicking together.
"I have control over the very stones," she raised her arms. "I will prove my power is greater than Mithras. With a single strike, I will bring down this chamber."
The ghosts wailed and trembled and looked at the ceiling. But Annabeth knew they didn't see what she saw. These ghosts were warriors, not engineers. The children of Athena had many skills, and not just in combat. Annabeth had studied architecture for years. She knew this ancient chamber was on the verge of collapse. She recognized what the stress fractures in the ceiling meant, all emanating from a single point. The top of the stone arch just above her. The capstone was about to crumble. And when that happened, assuming she could time it correctly...
"Impossible!"
the potter shouted.
"The weaver has paid us much tribute to destroy any children of Athena who would dare to enter our shrine. We have never let her down. We cannot let you pass."
"Then you fear my power," Annabeth said. "You admit that I could destroy your sacred chamber."
The potter scowled. He straightened his hat uneasily. Annabeth knew she'd put him in an impossible position. He couldn't back down without looking cowardly.
"Do your worst,